This is chapter 20. 20 in Ashcroft and Merman. And it's basically addressing the question of what structure will form. The question that was asked a few times already, because we went over the Bravais lattices, we said these are the structures that can be formed. And this addresses in a very rudimentary fashion. So this is a very hard calculation. It'll ultimately, I guess, in condensed matter, what we'd like to do is say, okay, you give me 10 to the 23rd electrons, and you give me 10 to the 23rd ion. So literally you take, suppose in the case of sodium, you take 10 to the 23rd positively charged ions of charge 11 each, and then you take 11 times 10 to the 23rd electrons, each with charge minus E, you throw them all in a bag and you ask, what happens? What's going to happen when you lower the temperature? And what you should find, what's realized in nature, is it'll form a structure. I forget, sodium I think is FCC. It'll form a structure that has certain properties at low temperatures, and that's what the cohesive energy calculation tries to address. And we can't do a really good job. There's a huge cancellation of energies involved, and besides, it's not an experiment we do routinely. We don't send off all those electrons. You're basically taking apart the solid and sending all the constituents off to infinity in different directions and comparing the two energies. So that's the cohesive energy. And then the calculations generally assume that, I shouldn't say that, but the ones that presented in chapter 20 assume that the ions are sort of fixed in some position, and that's referred to as the static model. So what we'll talk about today is beyond the static model. Which means that the ions can move around. Okay, so, and ultimately, if you want to formulate a complete theory of solids, you're going to want to describe the melting transition to the point where ions move around to such a degree that the solid actually ceases to exist. And there's a phase transition, and it becomes a liquid. That's really hard, and that's not something we're going to do here, and it's not something that's well understood in general. What we're going to do here is we're going to consider a small excursions from equilibrium. Okay, and so we get into the realm of what are called lattice vibrations. So we're going to consider basically atoms that jiggle around their equilibrium positions. And this ultimately leads to the notion of phonons. So this is, phonons are nothing but really the quantum version, the quantized version of lattice vibrations. So, how do we begin? Well, as far as the ions are concerned, they all possess, okay, and the notation I've been using is closer to summing over all the positions we sum over the momenta. So this is the momentum operator, and if we wanted to use coordinates, we would write this as, you know, it's p dot p, so it's p mu p mu. So mu here is equal to x, y, and z. And the sum over r, as always, is over the Bravais lattice vectors. And then there's some potential energy, we'll call it U, which exists between every pair of ions. Let me designate the ionic position as R, which is a function of its equilibrium position. So we have in mind a solid. This is a unit cell. Let's take a cubic solid for simplicity. There are ions at all of these positions, but in actual fact, they're actually not right on those equilibrium positions. They have these small excursions away from their equilibrium positions. So in fact, I'm going to, so let me finish here. This is a sum over all equilibrium positions, because I want to sum over all those ions, and then there's some interaction, pairwise interaction, between this is R minus R prime. And I'm already writing it as the difference, okay? It depends simply on the magnitude of the difference of the coordinates. If this ion moves over to here and that one moves over to there, it's this separation distance that matters. And I'm then going to write this as 1/2 sum over R and R prime. So I have the sum over all ions twice. And then I have a half, so because this is clearly double counting. And so the half takes away the double counting. And it should be understood that R is not equal to R prime in this sum as well. So then this is equal to U of, I'm going to write now this R as equal to the equilibrium position, which is uppercase Ri, plus some small amplitude, which I'll call U. So U of R or U of Ri. I guess I'm not using subscripts I. So then I will do this expansion. And I'll do it for each of these lowercase r's, and I'll get r, and again, I'm being sloppy here. I'm not writing vector signs, right? I should be writing vector signs for every single one of these guys. So this is a vector, this is a vector, this is a vector, that's a vector. These are vectors. And then I have u of r minus u of r prime. And since I assume that each one of these is small, their difference, I can assume, will be small as well. And I do an expansion in the difference. So I get 1/2 sum over R prime, U of R minus R prime, plus 1/2 sum over R prime, U of R minus U of R prime, dotted into the gradient operator, which then acts on U of R minus R prime. And I'll have to go to the next order, which is then given by a term like this. Plus order u cubed. And there's been a lot of work over the years on this. And for example, if this is a simple Bravais lattice, no basis, suppose there was a basis, then I'd have to worry about R sub j equal to R plus d sub j plus u of R sub j, where j enumerates all the atoms in the basis. So, for example, in a two-dimensional, better draw it bigger than that. I mean, suppose I have a two-dimensional lattice that looks like this. These are, suppose at each Bravais lattice point, this is a square lattice, I have not one particular atom that's of that type, but I have a second atom. And these have to be drawn identically, right? So that's a basis now at each lattice point, at each Bravais lattice point. But if I want to develop a theory of lattice vibrations, I have to worry about each one of these atoms vibrating separately, independently of the other. So I now have to worry about both of these associated with the lattice point R, and the D is what delineates both of them. So in this case, I'd have D1 equals 0, and D2 is equal to, 1 plus delta minus delta in this two-dimensional lattice, where delta is this distance. And that D2 would be the same for every single lattice point, because that's the equilibrium position. The thing that would be different for every single lattice point is the U. It's the excursion away from equilibrium. This you recognize as U equilibrium. That's the zero temperature value. And by the way, what I'm doing now is the theory of lattice vibration. So this is the classical theory. Okay, there's no zero-point motion in this, for example. Okay, it's just simply the classical theory. And then what do I do with this? Well, you can see there are separate sums over R and R prime, and this term has either R or R prime. I can change variables and so on. And what am I left with? I'm left with something that looks like the sum over R or R prime, doesn't matter, of the gradient of this potential. Okay, and then there's a sum over R as well. What is that? That is simply the force exerted on the ion at R by all the other ions in the lattice. Right? Force, the gradient of the potential gives you the force, the negative, the gradient of the potential. And I'm summing over the R prime, so I'm summing over all the atoms. So that's zero. It's zero by definition because I'm claiming that what I'm expanding around is the equilibrium structure, and the definition of it being the equilibrium structure is that there are no atom wants to go anywhere. It's happy where it is. So there are no forces acting on any of the atoms in the equilibrium structure. So this is by definition zero. So the first order expansion gives you zero. That's why we had to go to second order. And so now if I write out what that second order term is, so I will refer to this as U harmonic, because this is simply the potential energy in the harmonic approximation, because now it looks like a set of harmonic oscillators. Well, maybe it doesn't look like that quite yet, but it will. And so that U harmonic is 1/4 times sum over R prime, and you can write that a little more simply as U of R minus U of R prime times I think we call it phi of R minus R prime times U of R minus R prime. U of R minus U of R prime. And if I write this, you know, this is a vector times a matrix times a vector. If I can just use the components. Like that, and I'm summing over mu and nu equal x, y, and z, and then it looks okay. And phi mu nu is simply the second derivative now of that potential. At a general position r, lowercase r, say, but that will be at the equilibrium positions. And this, in turn, is often written as 1/2 sum of r prime like that, where so it looks like a small displacement times some matrix times a small displacement, where d of mu nu of r minus r prime is delta of r and r prime sum over r double prime phi mu nu and then minus phi mu nu of r minus r prime. Okay. So again, classically, what would we do? Classically, we would want to calculate the partition function. Well, we'd want to calculate, say, the energy density. And classically, this is the integral over all phase space of the total energy, I guess E to the minus beta E, all divided by this thing, which can be written as simply log of this integral over phase space.
Okay,
yeah.
The notation is kind of fixed, right? Because we are using DTU to account for the
yeah, displacements.
Yeah, for the displacement. So
sorry. So let's just keep it like that. Although even this capital, this is really energy. Let's do it like that. And then in here, let me use H for Hamiltonian, even though it's the classical Hamiltonian. Any other questions? So, and we write this as the derivative, so the derivative with respect to beta, because it's in the log, this thing goes in the bottom, and we pull down an H just like there, and there's a minus sign. So that's good. How do we deal with this? Well, H, what's H? H is P squared plus U squared. So I'm writing it very schematically, right? There's a sum here and a sum here, but H consists of this energy plus this initial energy here, which had the P squared, the kinetic energy. So if I and D gamma, I should have defined D gamma, I guess, is it's du for every lattice site and dp for every lattice site, but it and it can be in every direction. So this is a huge product over all the lattice sites and over x, y, and z. Okay, that's the phase space, the usual classical phase space. Well, as soon as I see H looking like this, well, first of all, to carry it to the next step, you have to know why what are we motivated to find here? We're often motivated to find the energy or energy density as a function of parameters of the system that we can control. So pressure, for example, and that comes through the volume here. But the other obvious parameter that we always fiddle around with, at least in condensed matter physics, is temperature. We raise and lower the temperature. That's what causes all these phase transitions, by and large. So we really want to know what it is as a function of temperature, and then we do measurements to verify that. And one of the things we measure very often is the specific heat. And the specific heat is just the change in energy density here as a function of temperature. Okay, so you see how well the material can retain heat. The subscript volume here, because if you remember your thermodynamics, these are functions of multiple variables, and when you're doing these experiments, when you're changing the temperature, you have to do it keeping something fixed. Could be the pressure, but in this case, it's the volume. So there's also something called C sub P, which says keep the pressure fixed while you change the temperature. And then you can do that measurement. So these are things that are actually measured. Okay. Yeah, and I'll tell you about those in a short bit. So when we know that the Hamiltonian is of this form, and we want to calculate the temperature dependence without having to necessarily calculate anything, we want to figure out this temperature dependence. Since we have to do this huge integral over many variables, then, and the temperature beta, let me remind you, is simply 1 over k Boltzmann T, so the temperature appears because of beta there, then I should get rid of the temperature here by doing a transformation of variables, because they're all going to be integrated over anyways. So if I write P tilde is equal to root beta times P, I do that for every component at every lattice site, and then I do the same thing for U, so U tilde is equal to that, then in this exponential, there is going to be exactly this combination squared. It'll be U squared times beta, and it'll be P squared times beta. And then these guys will change. So these guys will become simply the betas will go underneath, and this will become the product over all these guys of the tildes now. But then I'm going to get a 1 over beta to the 1 half for every one of those. So 1 over beta for the pair. But 1 over beta cubed, because there's x, y, and z. And then 1 over beta, not cubed, but to the power 3n, because there are n lattice points. And I'm doing a product over R here. So when I put all that stuff in, the integral of d gamma e to the minus beta h, which is what I need here, simply becomes beta to the minus 3n times a constant, times some number, right? When I end up doing all these integrals in this form, it's some number that's independent of temperature anyways. And so now I can write this as, so lowercase e, which was e over v, is equal to minus 1 over v di by di beta of log of beta to the minus 3n times a constant. I think that's right. There's a term that falls out of here, which because this H, in principle, this H also has not just U harmonic, which is this potential energy and this kinetic energy, but it has this constant. So we could put it in. Remember, constants don't really matter much in the end, and it won't matter here. But strictly speaking, there's also that one term. Now I can do this temperature derivative, and I simply get E is equal to this thing, and I pull down a minus 3n, I get a 1 over beta, so I get 3n over v times k Boltzmann times temperature. Which implies that this specific heat is simply 3n over v times k Boltzmann. And that means I get 3 times k Boltzmann for every single degree of freedom, meaning this n over b as a density. So first of all, it's a constant. So if I it's a constant. So if I plot the specific heat as a function of temperature, and I normalize it to usually to the number density, then I get this constant, which is 3 times k Boltzmann. So that's specific heat versus temperature. That is the classical. This is known as the Dulong-Petit law. Now, there were measurements, and I'll just sketch them here. They're in they're sketched in Ashcroft and Merman in one of the figures, and they're for noble gases. You know and the answer, the results are something that looks like this. Okay, so these are for argon, neon, I think, and xenon. First of all, why do they choose noble gases? Noble gases. Why do they choose noble gases? No, we're not looking.
Well, I mean, you can keep them in gas.
Oh.
You can cool them a lot before.
No, but these are measurements in the solid state.
Oh.
You want them as solids.
Yeah, sure. Your line is better.
Yeah. You want them as solids.
Yeah.
I haven't really said anything about this, but the reason why you pick on these is because there are no electrons. I mean, there are electrons, but the electrons are part of the ions. In other words, there aren't actually ions. I keep using the word ions in the case because I'm thinking of a metal like sodium, where there are sort of sodium ions and then itinerant electrons. In the noble gases, they're inert. The atoms are neutral. And the, quotes, ions have zero charge, and all the electrons that are there are completely tied to the ion. So if I take a noble gas and I start trying to move one of the argon atoms around, it will take with it all its electrons. It's one entity. Okay, so that's why, because we don't want, there's an electronic-specific heat. Did you cover that in the August lectures by chance?
Yeah.
So in the preliminary lectures for this course, you studied, I think, the free electron gas, and you derived what the temperature dependence of the electron gas is, for what the specific temperature dependence of the specific heat for the electron gas is. Anybody remember? It was linear in temperature at low temperature. So you don't want something that's linear in temperature messing around with a theory that's telling you should get a constant. right? Because suppose I did this on sodium and I got those results. So what's wrong with these results? Well, they're not constant. These are experimental results or sketches of experimental results. They're not constant. But if this was sodium, what would you tell me? You would tell me, oh, well, there's the electronic specific heat. Of course it has to go down. We derived that the electronic specific heat is linear in temperature. But no, I'm purposely addressing the noble gases, so there are no free electrons around. So this is not due to the temperature. We've sort of removed the electronic degrees of freedom and any temperature dependence that might be associated with the electronic degrees of freedom in the specific heat. Some of you might be wondering, hold on, wait a minute. What is all this stuff? There's this potential energy between these ions, and since I was using the word ions all the time, many of you had in your mind the Coulomb potential. Now I'm telling you there is no Coulomb potential because they're neutral. So what's this potential? Does anybody know what this potential is for the noble gases? Why do noble gases have atoms that interact with one another at all? If it's true that all the positive charge hangs out with all the negative charge for each atom, and so they're neutral.
Van der Waals forces.
Van der Waals forces, perfect. Exactly. Pardon?
Spontaneous dipole.
Yes. Spontaneous. So the potential that I didn't write down at the start because I decided to skip the cohesive energy part is one that represents the Van der Waal forces. And one of the most popular in use is called, does anybody know what it's called? The Leonard Jones potential. Okay, and that is a potential where the U, so this U of R minus R prime, say, is given by an expression which has a 1 over R minus R prime to the 12th minus some other constant times R minus R prime to the 6th. Okay, and that's the Leonard Jones potential. And so, Barbara, you mentioned the Van der Waals interaction, and I don't know how many of you remember, Van der Waals goes like 1 over R to the 6th. Okay, and that's the origin of this. The origin of this is that there's a hard core at some point. So you have to put that in at some point, and so this potential energy will look like that, and there'll be some equilibrium position, and then you can figure out, for example, the cohesive energy from there. But we've digressed a bit. So that's the potential that we've been talking about here, at least insofar as this applies to noble gases. And we've derived the specific heat, which is just involving these atomic degrees of freedom, I'll keep calling them ions, even though in this case they're not charged. And we discovered the Dulong-Petit law, which is the classical law. And I'm now telling you that that fails horribly at low temperatures. Okay, and this is in fact what Einstein addressed in 1907. So in 1907, way before quantum mechanics, he did a quantum calculation of this problem, what turns out to be a quantum calculation, to understand why this goes down. And he got it exponentially decreasing, which wasn't bad at the time, but it's in fact, the temperature dependence is a little different from that. Okay, so at this point, let's do an example, okay? And you'll have one in, I can't remember if it's a tutorial or the homework problem, but let's do a one-dimensional example. So as usual, we go down in dimensions because it just becomes more confusing than anything else to start carrying around all these indices and so on. So the one-dimensional example is a chain, and we'll suppose this chain has n atoms, and again, as is normally the case, we assume what are called Born von Karman boundary conditions. Which is that the quantity of, so each of these, this is like R1, R2, R3, dot, dot, dot. And associated with each of these is a U of one, we'll call it one, a U of two, and so on. And this one here, suppose we'll call it U of n sub n times A. So A is the equilibrium distance. So this is a one-dimensional Bravais lattice of atoms separated by distance A. So A, and on it goes. And so this will simply be called U times n plus 1 times A, and so on. And these Born von Karman boundary conditions simply tell us that U of n plus 1 times A is equal to U of 1 times A. And U of 0 times A is equal to U of n times A. In other words, this is, rather than being a really a one-dimensional chain, it's a circle. Okay, and if I were to worry about what does this ion interact with, it interacts with the ion to the left primarily, and a bit more to here and less so over here, but it also interacts with the ion to the right, which is in fact this one, because it's come full circle. So those are the Born von Karman boundary conditions. And this, for example, we'll come back to what that signifies later. So if I write down an expression for the harmonic potential for this chain, it's simply equal to the sum over all n of U n A minus U n plus delta times A all squared, and then I'll have a 1/2 a 1/2 sum over n, a 1/2 k delta. And I've got a sum over n and delta. What's delta? Delta is going to go from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, because let's focus on this U and A. It's going to interact with the n plus 1 with some coupling constant k sub 1. It'll interact with the next one over at UN plus 2 with some presumably weaker coupling constant, K sub 2, and so on. So if we use nearest neighbors only, then U harmonic is equal to 1 half, and the K comes out, sum over N, like that. I hope that hasn't been too confusing. So in principle, you can, and since we're using the harmonic approximation, the picture you have in mind is that there are sort of springs between two atoms. Remember, where did the springs come from? They came from basically a potential like this, right? Expanded to the harmonic approximation. And there's nothing stopping me. In fact, it's found experimentally to be necessary sometimes to not only couple this to the neighboring, so I'm not going to go to the left, I'll always go to the right. In fact, even when I write this notation, sum over delta, I'm always thinking of only to the right, because I've already counted the one on the left. Because when I'm summing over n, then when have I counted this coupling here? When n was back here, I was including that interaction. So I don't want to include it again. Okay, so I only include the ones to the right, and if I'm doing two dimensions, I only include the ones to the right and the ones above, not the ones to the left and the ones below. They've already been counted when I've been summing over the lattice. But that's a matter of how you do things. You can include both and put in an extra factor of a half if you like. So there's nothing stopping you from putting in a spring of another type that directly connects this atom to that atom, and then yet another one to the third nearest neighbor. Okay? Is that understood? Even if I don't do this, this atom is going to be sensitive to what goes on here because this is connected through a spring to this one, which is connected to a spring to that one. But if it's possible that there's a more direct connection as well. And how that's determined is often by comparing to experiments and seeing that you need some direct coupling in order to understand what the experiments are telling you. Okay, so if this is the harmonic potential, then this is classical theory. We know the equations of motions. They're F equals ma, right? It's minus, lowercase m d squared u n a by dt squared is equal to minus the derivative of the potential and minus, so this gives me minus k over 2. F equals ma, so m d squared u by dt squared equals minus k over 2 times 2. So if I take the derivative of this with respect to u sub n, I get u sub n a minus u n plus 1. But I get another term, which is minus 2 u n minus 1 sub a minus u n a. Right? So what do I get that second term? Because when I'm doing this sum, that the term you're seeing right there is when I'm at n. So the term you're seeing is the spring between this n and that n plus 1. And I have to take the derivative with respect to u of n. But does U of N come anywhere else? Well, yes, it comes in when I'm considering the previous term, which is really the N minus 1 term. Because when I'm considering that term, I also have the same kind of spring connecting to U of N. So there are actually two terms in this expression that contain that U of NA directly. Okay, and that's these two terms. So then I get K over K4 over 2, so 2 UNA minus UN plus 1 plus UN minus 1. Okay, so that's the equation of motion, and the solution you've probably done in a classical physics course. What is that? That's so in a classical physics course, you find that U of NA can be expanded in modes, and there's simply given like this. And I guess you get that. So if you substitute that into that equation, then you get m omega squared. So this omega squared comes down. And that can be a function of k, so I better put it in here. And then that's equal to I've got k, and then I've got the sum over k, and I've got 2 uk minus UK 1 minus, and those other ones will have UKs, and they'll all have this exponential. But inside here, there'll be an extra e to the IKA, because that has an n plus 1 here. So the plus 1 times ka gives me e to the ika, and the other term has e to the minus ika. So I get that. And the 2 should be in here. Now I can take both sides and multiply by basically an e to the minus I p n a minus omega t, and sum over all the n's and discover that p equals k. And so this implies that the coefficients have to be equal to one another. So the coefficients being equal to one another says that omega k squared is equal to minus k over m. So do I have a minus sign error? F equals ma equals the negative of the potential.
Yeah. There should be a minus.
Somewhere up there?
Because the U and A should be a minus.
Actually, I think yeah, the minus sign comes from differentiating the potential F. because that's minus du over displacement.
Yeah, so that's the outside minus.
The outside minus.
So where? Oh, yeah, so the last line has a minus sign.
Yeah.
So it's just a trivial. So there's a minus sign there. And so there's a minus sign here, and so now the minus signs cancel. The u's cancel, and then I get a 2. And if I put 2 under here, I get 1 minus cos ka. And then cos ka is equal to 1 minus 2 sine squared ka over 2. So this becomes 4 k over m times sine squared ka over 2. So then I get that omega k is equal to 2 times root k over m times sine of ka over 2, absolute value. So then I glossed over it, but this k, which I introduced way back here, that k is just considering basically one number for this thing here is called the dynamical matrix. Okay, if I'm in one dimension, there is no sum over mu and nu to worry about. And if I only include nearest neighbor coupling, this r minus r prime, there's only one value that concerns us, which is the nearest neighbor distance. So this matrix ends up being one number. And that's what makes one of the things that makes this particularly easy. So I've now found these energies, and I can if I plot them. I also this k. Again, I was going to come back to that. Remember the boundary conditions. So basically, I have these uks go like e to the I kna, but the boundary condition says that when n is equal to 0, it should be equal to n is equal to n. Well, that happens if e to the I k n a is equal to 1, e to the 0. And that means that k is equal to 2 pi times some integer divided by n and divided by a. So k is the wave vector. It has units of 1 over length, which is in the A. And furthermore, this says that n is between capital N over 2 and minus N over 2. I mean, it can go beyond, but if it goes beyond, I'm just getting more factors of 2 pi, which don't do anything new. So this again drives home the point of the Brillouin zone. So putting this in here says that k is less than or equal to pi over a, and is less than minus pi over a. And when we deal with capital N equal 10 to the 23rd, we don't worry about the fact that there's no equality sign here. It's just between those two. But when we're dealing as a theorist often does with smaller numbers, then you would worry about it. So we go between minus pi over a and pi over a, and this dispersion is a sine function, and it looks, it's completely symmetric for negative and positive. This is omega sub k, and we get that result. In particular, if you look down here, then omega k is basically a times root k over m times lowercase k, the magnitude. Okay, and that is the dispersion of sound. So this is often referred to as an acoustic branch. Acoustic because of sound, branch because it's not obvious here, there's only one curve, but when you're doing the general theory of phonons or lattice vibrations, not in one dimension and maybe with a basis, there are many branches, there are many solutions. Okay, so it's the acoustic branch, although it's really only this low energy part that corresponds to a sound wave in the sense that it's linear in wave vector, linear in momentum. Okay, so I could go, there's an example in the notes, which I think I won't go through, which deals with a 1D lattice with a basis. Okay, but just...
This is the tutorial problem, but the atoms will have different masses.
Okay, the one I formulated, it has different spring constants. But they're the same. So I won't say anything. So then you have something to do. Otherwise, you're going to be wondering what to do this afternoon or tomorrow afternoon. Let me just see what else I wanted to say. Any questions about up to this point? Okay, let me just say a few general things about moving on to extra dimensions, and then we'll start the quantum version. So first, you're going to have to worry more about this dynamical matrix. Okay, and that's going to be the key. That's we didn't have to calculate anything. We just called it K because it was one there, but when you're dealing with a higher dimensional problem, and you're going to want to look more than nearest neighbors only, you'll need to know more about this matrix. So first, d of mu nu of r is the same as d mu nu of minus r. So it depends on the magnitude, as I said earlier. But it's also true that this, when you flip the indices, that these are also equal. So then, mu, nu. Okay, so that's got the indices flipped. And it's also true that the sum over r and that last property is important, and it can be subtle, and it shows up in theory of nuclei, for example. So this corresponds to and I could drive it, but I won't here. But physically, what it corresponds to, the reason why this is zero is because there are these displacements. right, for all the individual ions. And we're going to, as you saw in the example, and it'll be generally true for what I say now, even in higher dimensions, we go to wave vector space. And so I'm going ahead of myself, but just let me explain what that thing is about. Suppose I take every single atom and I displace it by the same amount in the same direction. What do I have? I have the same crystal simply displaced over a little bit. Has the energy changed? No. So this thing equals zero is telling you that what I just told you. Okay, it tells you that and it goes back to Q equals zero. So Q equals zero mode, so right down here, what is that? That is just displacing all the atoms by the same amount. Okay, so in nuclei, this was a big issue. And it's called center of mass motion, right? Because after all, taking all 10 to the 23rd atoms and just moving them over is like moving the center of mass of the crystal, which we're not interested in. That part doesn't govern the thermodynamics of that crystal or any phase transitions, right? If I take my crystal and I do experiments on it while I'm moving on a train, you know, the ice doesn't melt any differently when it's moving on a train than it does just here in the lab. So that's what that Q equals zero mode reflects. And in nuclei, as I said, this was a problem. They had to remove that because they didn't want those effects because they're kind of trivial and not involved in the binding of nuclei, so they're called spurious center of mass effects, but that is reflected in this property. So if we run through, let me just run through what we did. So maybe I should start a new board over here. So front comes down. We have the mass. And this is a vector, let me write it as a vector. So we have this equation, and this is now a matrix, and this is a vector. Matrix times a vector gives a vector, and that's a vector. Right, so that's all good. And we're going to write now U, so we'll do it slightly differently than what I did over there because I wrote it as an expansion. Here I'll just write it as a plane wave. So this is one of your basis vectors, if you like, out of which the entire set of phonon modes can be constructed. We now need a vector here. This is called a polarization vector. In the one-dimensional example over here, this didn't really show up. It was in the UK. But since there was only one coupling constant, that canceled out. It was like a one-dimensional matrix. So it just didn't show up. But now, when we're dealing with three dimensions, there's a polarization vector. And the Born-von-Karman boundary conditions generalizes to a sum over the reciprocal, over multiples of the reciprocal lattice vectors. And now the n is n1 times n2 times n3. Or I can call them nx, ny, nz. They're the length. And those are typically 10 to the 23rd in all directions. So so the total number is simply the product of those. If we substitute this into that, we will then get, and we use the time dependence, we will get m omega squared is times epsilon is equal to d of k times epsilon. Where d of k is now the Fourier transform of d of r. So notice this, what I said over here, that this was equal to zero, is just if I put k equal to zero here, then I'm summing over, this is one, I'm just summing over the d of r's. So that's how that corresponds to the k equals zero mode, this sort of, which is this displacement of the center of mass. These are matrices. And what is this? This is, so this is a matrix times a vector. This is a in three dimensions, this is a three-dimensional eigenvalue equation. So we're going to get three solutions for each of n modes labeled by k. Okay, so this is true for every single k, but there are n k's because these integer lowercase n1, n2, n3 have the same restrictions as these integers here for each of their, for x, y, and z. And if I work with this, I get the d of k is equal to minus 2 times the sum over r of d of r sine squared dot r over 2. So it's in fact an even function of k, as it should be. It's real. Everything here is real now. And both of these things, and it's also symmetric. Again, I won't show that, but it follows from all those properties. So it's real, symmetric, and this implies that there are real eigenvalues and if we use this form, real eigenvectors. So we have this eigenvalue problem. It would be, it more recognizable, maybe to write it like this. Let me write these as vectors, and then this is a kind of a matrix, and these are the eigenvalues. And these eigenvalues are simply m omega s squared. And I'm going to put labels s on these because s is equal to 1, 2, or 3, these label the solutions of this 3 by 3 matrix. So every solution will have a label k, and there are n of those, and every solution will have a label s, which can take on 3 values. And so these solutions will be orthonormal, which says that this dotted into this, right? For a given k, I get 3 solutions, and those 3 solutions are orthonormal. Okay. Any questions about this up to this point? Because now I'm going to in the time remaining here, I'll just quickly go through the quantization of this, which is, I suspect, something familiar to many of you. If you've at all quantized the electromagnetic field, then this is the same procedure. But I'll go through it anyways here. So any questions? Front. Middle. So the quantum mechanical version of this is straightforward. That energy that we said was energy density is just going to be, now instead of integrating over phase space, we sum over all possible states, eigenstates in the system, and we sum over their energies. So, like before, it's just given by a derivative with respect to beta of log of the partition function. We just have to calculate the partition function. Z is equal to sum over I e to the minus beta EI. So we have to solve for the eigenstates of this problem. And the problem, let me define it again. In the harmonic approximation, it's the sum over all latticites of this operator P sub R squared over 2m plus 1/2 sum over r prime u of mu r d of mu nu r minus r prime, like so. So these are coupled oscillators. Right? They're not of the form, nice form of p squared plus, or like p1 squared plus u1 squared, because there are some u1, u2 terms and things like that. So we have to decouple these. But that can always be done because it's quadratic in the operators. So we know there's some transformation that can do it. And just like when we had the simple harmonic oscillator, we had p squared plus q squared with the various coefficients, and then we formed these, we wrote q was equal to root h bar over 2 m omega times a plus a dagger, so we got these raising and lowering operators, and p was minus I m omega over 2 a minus a dagger. And that led to this thing becoming a dagger a. So now we're going to do the same thing, but it's a little bit more involved. And let me just write down the transformation for you. So you write, well, first you would write down that u of r is equal to sum over k of e to the I k dot r times u of k. And similarly, p of r is equal to the sum over k. And I guess I'll put a 1 over root n, 1 over root n times e to the I k dot r of p of k. So these are simply Fourier transforms. And then you would write u of k So here's where we would simply write a plus a dagger, but there's other stuff going on. First of all, there are these polarization vectors. So we have an epsilon s of k, and that's the vector. We have this root h bar over 2 m omega s of k. So now omega is a function of k. Okay, so I had to do this first step. I can't simply write u as somehow a plus a dagger, because all the normal modes in this system are not local. They don't involve a single ion. They involve all the ions. And so we have to go to wave vector space to get the normal modes. And then we have a k sub s, and we'll find that we need a minus k sub s right here. And that's about it. And similarly, p is minus I. And then you get the same factor that we got before, but now, again, omega s is a function of k, and then we get a k sub s minus a minus k. And the inverses of these, so these should have hats on them, a sub ks is, well, let me write it out in full. So, by the way, this is now moving on to chapter 23 in Ashcraft and Merman, but it's also looking particularly at Appendix L in that same book. Epsilon S of K times M omega S of k over 2 h bar square root of times u of r plus the square root of 1 over 2m h bar omega s k times p of r. And there should be an I here. And similarly, a sub ks dagger sum over r of e to the I k dot r epsilon s of k times the same thing except there's a minus sign here. And these obey all the orthonormality relations you would imagine them to obey. Well, for example, A, and the commutation relations too. This now has Kronecker deltas in both the wave vectors and in the polarizations. So it's derived in the notes, but I'm not going to do that here. You put all this stuff into the Hamiltonian here, and it's a little involved because for this term you have to use the eigenvector equation, which is up here. You have to use it judiciously, but all of this comes down to basically what you would expect, which is that this is simply the sum over all the normal modes now, the ones, the n k values and the three s values for each of the k values, times h bar omega s k times n k s plus a half. And this is the Bose distribution function. So, and I think I'm not going to derive that either because I think you did that in a statistical mechanics course before this one. So instead of just having h bar omega n plus a half, you now have, because this is a mini-coupled system, you have a sum over all those normal modes of that same quantity. Okay. Better stop. So any questions? Is this something that's familiar to people or not, what I've done today? Sort of? Kind of? Okay, anyways, it's done. So I'll carry on with some examples of some quantum models and also tell you a bit about neutron scattering next class. By the way, last class we celebrated Remembrance Day, and I put up that poem by John McCrae. What I neglected to tell you is he's actually from here, from this area, Guelph actually, so close by, which I had forgotten. But he's from around here.